Okay, welcome everybody. This is the third lecture for the Mises Academy class, Austrian Economics 1, Praxeology through Price Theory, which is basically the first half of Chapter 2. All right, so you should be able to get the PowerPoint slides. Danny has put the URL up, and he's doing it again right now in the chat box. And why don't we just go ahead and get going. All right, so a lot of what I'm going to do in this lecture is just make sure you get the big picture and understand the structure of what Rothbard's doing. Because I think any individual argument, it's going to be pretty straightforward. There's nothing too difficult in this portion of the book. So I just want to make sure you see the big picture and see the framework that he's operating in. Okay, so he actually has this outline later on in the chapter, but I want to show it to you up front. So the idea is what he's done is before in Chapter 1, we just talked about the implications of action per se. Okay, so everything we said in Chapter 1 is true of Mother Teresa, it's true of Robinson Crusoe sitting on a desert island, and it's true of an axe murderer. Okay, because we were just looking at the implications of the fact that people act per se. You know, what sort of things can we conclude from the fact that there are, or that there is at least one being that has a mind? And remember, mind is distinct from brain. Okay, mind is the intangible thing that has goals. And, you know, a lot of people think it's associated with the physical brain, but technically mind is distinct. It's a different concept. So, you know, we can't see somebody's mind, we can't see somebody's goals, that's stuff that we attribute to them. We can observe the movements of their body. And so what we do as social scientists or as economists or actually as praxeologists, the best term, is we explain a lot of what happens in the social world. We explain the movements of people's bodies and so forth by saying, oh, what I see here, my hypothesis is, the explanation I'm going to use is that there's at least one or maybe multiple minds at work, and those are distinct beings that have goals and they have reason, and so they're trying to use means to achieve their ends. All right, so that's what action is. So the things we developed in Chapter 1, you know, first of all, he did talk about action per se and implications. And then the specific illustrations of it were confined to what's called autistic exchange, meaning just one person. So he was exchanging with nature, if you want to look at it that way. All right, so now in Chapter 2, he's going to start talking about interpersonal action, right, meaning action when there's more than one person involved. And then there's two main categories of that. One is violent action that's actually either, you know, literally based on violence or there's a threat of it, with intimidation and so forth. And then the other main category is non-invasive action. And so there you exchange goods or goods move around, I should say, either because of someone just giving it to somebody else or because of a voluntary exchange. Okay, so as far as violence goes, I mean, he has a taxonomy of it and goes through the various classification schemes and breaks it down. I don't think I need to go over that with you guys. I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's not that it's unimportant, but it's just I'm not going to add much by going through all the ways he analyzes it. Right? It's pretty obvious how that works. As far as voluntary exchange, so that's what we're going to now talk about, not only for the rest of this chapter, but for a good portion of the book. Okay, so again, just to repeat, Chapter 1, we talked about action per se, and then we did some illustrations of it confined to the one-person world, talking about Robinson Crusoe. And so, again, all that stuff is true. You know, there's sort of a presumption that Robinson Crusoe was an all right kind of guy, but again, it could have been a psychopath. The point is, and this is sort of a theme that's in Mises and that Rothbard picks it up, the norms we have for morality and things like that, they only really even make sense if you have at least two people, right? That if you just have one person on a tropical island somewhere, it's at least in the framework that Mises used, and I think that Rothbard picked it up. It almost doesn't, for those guys, for those thinkers, it almost doesn't make sense to talk about could someone behave immorally on a tropical island. So, you know, if you think about it, even if you're going to be religious and say, well, yeah, because, you know, maybe you swear a lot or maybe you, maybe you eat the coconuts without giving a blessing or something like that. If you're a religious person, you think you're supposed to do that, and so you're sinning or whatever. Even there, technically what you're doing is your actions are an affront to God. Okay, so there's two beings involved. Okay, so that's, you know, that's what Mises and I think Rothbard following him are getting at here, is that you can't have violence if there's only one person. And just more generally, you can't have any kind of crime. That if there's only one person and there's just a bunch of natural resources sitting around, you can't do anything that's criminal. I mean, you might do something that is counterproductive according to your own value scale. You could still make mistakes. You might think, you know, oh, gee, I want to get more coconuts, so I'm going to, you know, dance around and make some noises, and that I think will influence the cloud terrain. And then it doesn't, and you say, shoot, I made a mistake. But it's, I got a lot of excitement going on next door in the office. But it's not that you did something criminal. Right, whereas you can, you know, there are different norms involved when there's society. Okay, and so we'll, as we go through, we might talk a little bit more about that. But anyway, I just want to point out that's something that Mises says explicitly, and Rothbard kind of hints at it. But I think Rothbard absorbed that angle of things, because Mises was utilitarian, not really necessarily the right word, but he thought the whole reason for having social norms and rules of morality was to maintain the bonds of the division of labor, to make sure everyone respected property rights, because that was such a more productive society. All right, he wasn't really worried about some cosmic justice being performed or not. It was just more, he thought social living requires people to behave themselves in a certain way, and that's what law and morality is all about. Okay, so so anyway, now we're talking about, so in chapter one we talked about autistic exchange. Chapter two, he briefly talks about the possibility of violence. You know, there's a whole class of interpersonal action that's based on violence. So he mentions it just to show, you know, to fill out the framework, but he says, we're not going to really deal with that for now, for the rest of this chapter, and then for a while in the book, we're just going to focus on a voluntary contractual society, spinning out the implications of what all of us would just call the free market. Okay? And so then at the end of man, economy, and state, and then what would be all of power and market, he'll get into, Rothbard will talk about what happens now. Let's come back to the analysis of when people start trying to achieve their ends with violence, and that can include political action. All right? Okay. Sorry, we got stuff going on out there. Okay, so as far as voluntary exchange, the ground level, the basic thing about it is that every voluntary exchange requires reverse valuations, right? And so Rothbard has a little diagram, and I just fleshed it out to make it more concrete. He has person A and B and good X and Y, so I just tried to make it more concrete. So the idea is whenever people trade something, if it's voluntary, they each expect to benefit from the trade. And on the one hand, this is like so obvious, you're going to say, why are we even spending time on this? But it's really important. This is the heart of modern subjective value theory. And even though it is obvious, if you didn't start out on this foot, you'd be hopelessly lost in trying to explain commerce and market prices and so on. So just to give you an illustration of that, there was a tradition, I think, going back at least to Aristotle, saying that in a market transaction, it's only just if the people are exchanging things of equal or comparable or equivalent value, right? Because the idea they had in mind was if one person gives us something that's really valuable and the other person only gives us something that's a little bit valuable, well, then the first guy got ripped off. You know, so the idea was you don't want one party to the exchange walking away with the thing that's clearly better, you know, because then that means he must have stuck it to the other guy. All right, so we can see that actually, no, that doesn't make any sense. And in fact, it's the opposite, that if two people thought two goods were actually equivalent in value, then why would they trade? What would be the point? If you gave up something and received something that you thought was the same in terms of your value, your own personal valuation, why would you do that? Okay, so now there are ways you could try to rehabilitate that. You know, and there's scenarios where if some little kid wants to buy something and some grown kind of takes advantage of them, you know, you could say, oh, that's, you're cheating a little kid or what have you, because the kid didn't really know the value of the money he was giving up or whatever. All right, so I'm not saying that we just completely dealt with that, but certainly the premise that in a market exchange, in order for it to be just, the two parties have to give up things of comparable value, that's by itself, not only is it wrong, but it doesn't even make sense, because again, value is subjective. All right, so here, this silly example, Alice and Billy, and just to remind you about Rothbard's notation, when he's doing value scales, remember, parentheses denote something that the person doesn't have, whereas a lack of parentheses means the person possesses it. So here, Alice starts out, she has a xylophone, she doesn't have a yam, and according to her personal valuation, she would rather have a yam than a xylophone, because the yam is higher on the value scale than a xylophone, and the opposite's the case with Billy. So if Alice and Billy become aware of each other and they see an opportunity, they can have a gain from trade, because Billy gives up his yam in exchange for Alice's xylophone, and they both walk away better off. Okay, so again, I'm walking through this slowly, even though it's really simple, because it's profound, and it's an important foundation for modern subjectivist economics. That's a very significant thing that I just said. Alice and Billy both walk away from this trade happier than they went into it. Right? And so that's what we mean when we say there are gains from trade. And notice that that's only possible because value is subjective. Right? So it wouldn't be possible, for example, for Alice and Billy to both walk away from the trade with a heavier object than what they went into it with, right? Because weight is an objective property of objects, and you know, weight is not in the eye of the beholder. Either the yam or the xylophone is heavier, probably the xylophone, and so if Alice walks into the trade with the heavier object and then she walks away with the yam, she's leaving with the lighter object, okay, and Billy's walking away with the heavier, so it can't be they both walk away with a good that's heavier, or with a good that has more calories, or with a good that is brighter, okay? Because these are all properties that are intrinsic to the object; they're objective features of it, not interpretations in the eye of the beholder. Whereas value, in the economic sense, is in the eye of the beholder, and so that's why it makes perfect sense to say both people walked away with the more valuable object, because Alice's valuations are different from Billy's. All right, so again, if you don't start off on this footing, you have no hope of explaining consumer behavior and price theory and so on. And this is, even though it's very simple, this is how you start building up modern consumer and price theory. Okay, so Rothbard goes on then and says that beyond just, you know, single objects in just terms of one-shot swaps like that, even if there are multiple units involved, it's always the same principle operating It's just applied on the margin to the marginal unit. Okay, so this diagram, which is a little bit confusing at first, is just trying to show you that the dots are the cows and the crosses are the horses. And the idea is Joan starts out with, let me remember, so his marginal utility of this, so he has, so Joan starts out with a bunch of horses and no cows and vice versa for Smith. And then they start saying, how many do we want to trade with each other? Okay, so it's not just a matter of I have a xylophone and you have a yam, let's swap or not. It's now saying I have five horses and the other guy has five cows. And then we say, hey, do we want to trade one or more of these things? Okay, so here, again, it's the same thing. If you want, you know, in your mind, just don't think of it as five horses. Think of it as, you know, good A, good B, good C, good D, and good E. And then for the other guy, good F, G, H, I, and J. And then just do the evaluation scale that way and just do they want to swap or not, and that you'd be fine to do it that way. But in terms of if you're cognizant of the fact that they're multiple units of the same good, then the only tricky thing is you got to realize the marginal utility of a cow or a horse depends on how many units you currently have in your possession. So for the first trade, for example, we say, all right, Jones, does he want to trade his fifth horse for his first cow? Because remember, Jones starts out with five horses and no cows. So would Jones be willing to give up one horse for one cow? And you look at his value scale, the left-hand one here. Let me do my pointer tool. Danny reminded me this worked. All right, so we're over here. Hopefully that worked for you guys. Looking at this. So on that first unit of either one, what that, you know, having the circle up here and the X down here, what Rothbard is showing is that the marginal utility of that first cow is a lot higher to Jones than the marginal utility of his fifth horse. And so he would very gladly give up that fifth horse to obtain his first cow. And then if we say, okay, what about, would he do it again? So now we're looking at the second column. You'd say, okay, well, now this circle here is lower than that circle in terms of their height on the y-axis, whereas this x is higher than that x. Okay, so what's happening is the marginal utility of horses has gone up because now he's on his fourth horse, whereas before he was on his fifth horse. And on the other hand, the marginal utility of cows has gone down because now he's considering, do I want to acquire a second cow rather than that first cow? Okay, so that's what's going on. And so, you know, remember, step back and say what all of this stuff is always related back to the person's ultimate ends and how these goods can be used as means to achieve those ends. So the reason the fourth horse has a higher margin utility for Jones than the fifth horse, it's not because of some empirical regularity, it's because of the nature of action. Whatever it is that Jones wants to do with horses, whether he wants to, you know, race them or sell them off next month at an auction or, I don't know, just have a film crew come in and film them or something and pay him money because they're going to make a movie based on horses. Whatever it is he's going to do, maybe he wants to eat them. Okay, maybe he wants to do something that we think is silly, like let his horses teach his kids how to read. Okay, that strikes us as crazy, but maybe that's what he wants to do. But the point is, the more horses he has, the more of his potential uses for horses that he can satisfy. And so that first horse is going to go towards the thing he considers most urgent that can be satisfied by a horse, and then so on and so forth. So that's why, again, the law of marginal utility, or the law of diminishing marginal utility, is not some empirical thing. It's derived from the nature of action itself. Okay, so on this second one, again, the second column, the marginal utility of the fourth horse is higher than of the fifth horse, whereas the marginal utility of the second cow is lower than of the first cow. But it's still the case that the marginal utility of the fourth horse is lower than the marginal utility of the second cow. So Jones would be willing to swap another, or to swap again, to give up one more of his horses to obtain one more cow, and so on. All right, and then he would be actually be willing to do up to three of them. And then he wouldn't be willing to go one more, you know, so down here to the fourth, because at this point, the X is higher than the O. And so that shows that, no, he would be willing to trade up to three of his horses away in order to acquire up to three cows, but he wouldn't be willing to go once more, because at that point, the marginal utility of his second horse would be higher than the marginal utility of the, what would then be his fourth cow. Okay, now with Smith over here on the right-hand side, similar things happen for the first two units, right? But then he actually wants to stop after the second one, because by the third unit, that's where the X goes above the O on his value scale. Okay, so they actually only end up trading two units. The point is Jones would have been willing to do three, but Smith wants to stop after two. And so then they have to stop, because in a voluntary trade, both parties have to agree. Okay, so that's what's going on in this diagram. Let me just, before we leave this diagram, let me just give you a warning here. This value scale, it makes it look like it's this y-axis on these diagrams, on the left and the right diagrams here. It conveys that there is it's a cardinal scale. It gives you the idea that it's measuring utility or something. And strictly speaking, it's not. All right. So, for example, what I mean is, let's go back to Jones here. You can't look at the gap between that and that, and then say, oh, over here the gap has shrunk. It looks like maybe the difference between the two is about 20% lower than it was before, or maybe 35% lower. That doesn't make any sense. Okay. All you're really getting from this diagram is that the marginal utility of these units is either higher or lower than the other one. Okay, so ultimately, you could derive all this stuff just looking at an ordinal preference ranking. Okay, so again, it's not, you want to remember that here, the only information that makes sense that you can get from this is that the marginal utility of the third horse is higher or lower than the marginal utility of the fourth cow or what have you. Okay, so another interesting point here is that the possibility of exchange with others changes the valuation that people have of potential, of just the goods that are available, whether they possess them or whether they're out there in the world possessed by others. So Robinson Crusoe, he evaluates everything based on its direct use value to him. Now, don't be confused. The direct use value could mean its use as a capital good also. So when I say direct use value, I don't mean in terms of, is it directly useful in terms of satisfying my ends? It might be indirectly useful. All right, so it's a little bit confusing. But so what I mean is, Crusoe, he sees a coconut. Is that useful to him? Well, yes, because that can directly satisfy his hunger. He sees vines. Are those useful to him in terms of satisfying his hunger? Well, not directly. He's not going to eat the vine, but he can use the vine to make a net and then use the net to go get a bunch of fish, and then he can eat the fish to satisfy his hunger. So in the way that subjective value theory works, the vines do have direct use value for Crusoe, even though they're not consumption goods, they're capital goods. Okay, so everything that Crusoe values, he values because of its use value. Now, when Crusoe all of a sudden encounters other people on the island, and then they start trading with each other, and now there are markets. The point is, the way he himself values goods, various units of goods and so forth, their margin utilities, that can change based on a good's exchange value. Okay, because now when he evaluates goods, he doesn't merely ask himself, is that thing directly useful to me, either as a consumer or a capital good, but also, wait a minute, I can take that thing and go trade it with Jim down the street, or I guess over the hill, it's probably not paved roads on the island, and then he can give me something else that I personally value highly. And so now goods take on new significances based on the possibility of trading them away. So in a sense, what's going on, it's almost as if you've discovered a new technology. Right, so before, Crusoe looked at a vine and he thought, well, you know what I can do with that thing? I can take it, you know, mix some of my labor with it, if you will, and turn it into a net, and then that allows me to acquire more fish. So there he's using a technology, he's using a recipe of and transforming time and the vines and his labor into fish. But suppose he also discovers somebody over the next hill that owns a bunch of fish and thinks that vines are just beautiful pieces of artwork, you know, just loves to just hang vines up in his house. And that guy, for some reason, doesn't own any vines. Like, the vines are all on my side of the island, and we've agreed that, you know, there's a property line, and everything on this side is mine, everything over there is yours, and that guy just has tons of fish. Well, now it's like I figured out a new way to turn vines into fish. I don't have to make a net with them. I just go hand them over to this guy, and then all of a sudden fish magically appear. Okay, so that's kind of what's going on, that when people start exchanging with each other, one way to think about it is it's as if there's a new production technology. And actually, when we get to international trade, that's actually a really neat way to get around some of the fallacies of protectionism, is to just think about international trade as a new technology. Okay. So the last thing I said on this PowerPoint is, you know, in modern society, even a non-smoker might value a carton of cigarettes more highly than an apple. All right, so again, not be for his own use, but because he can trade it away. So what do I mean? That, let's say, I don't know, you're at a carnival or something, and you throw the ball and knock the stuff down, and then the barker comes and says, oh, great job, you win the prize. And what do we have available for our prizes? Okay, we've got this one apple and a carton of cigarettes. So you pick, which one do you want? Even if a person's a non-smoker and who, you know, personally hates cigarettes, the person might say, well, give me the carton of cigarettes, because he knows they have a much higher exchange value than a single apple. He'll take those, go swap it with somebody for money, and then go buy, you know, 50 apples with it. Okay, so the point is, that person, all of a sudden, his valuations of the marginal utilities of, you know, having one more carton of cigarettes versus one more apple change once he is aware of the possibility of exchanging those things away. Whereas if he didn't have access to markets and the carnival barker said, okay, your choice, do you want a carton of cigarettes or the apple? The person says, oh, give me the apple, because I can't use cigarettes. What the heck am I going to do with cigarettes? I don't smoke. All right, so that's the idea. Okay, another sort of obvious thing, but we need to spell it out, is that exchange requires property. And Rothbard doesn't give the full-blown exposition and derivation of Rothbardian property rights, but he does give a little bit of it. He gives you a taste to show that, look, in a voluntary society, how do you acquire ownership of something? And he walks through a few possibilities. So if it's something that's unowned, well, then he has this idea of homesteading, where you mix your labor with it, and then that's the way that you sort of take something out of its unowned status and make it owned by you. But then for things that are already owned, how does their ownership get transferred around? Well, it's either through a gift, somebody who's the original owner can just give it to somebody else as a gift, and so that transfers the ownership claim to somebody else, or through exchange. And the other thing going on is you might originally own the materials needed to produce something, and then you produce it. Okay, so that's the other way. So like a television set, how do you become the owner of it? Well, one way is if you owned all of the resources that went into its production. Well, then the physical act of creating the television set, you therefore are the owner of the resultant output because you owned everything that went into it. That's the idea. All right, so if you want to follow this stuff up more deeply, you would go look at Rothbard's book, The Ethics of Liberty. That's where he gives a very philosophical, full-blown treatment of starting from first principles, you know, how do we develop a body of libertarian law in terms of, you know, what are, how do property rights work? Can you sell yourself into slavery? What if somebody steals my TV? Can I go shoot the guy in the head? You know, that kind of stuff. Rothbard gives a full-blown treatment of those problems in the book, The Ethics of Liberty, if you're curious about seeing that. So for our purposes here, he doesn't do it too much, doesn't develop it too much, but he needs to mention the fact that, look, if we're talking about exchange, that presupposes property rights, because that's what it means to exchange things, is that technically it means I have the property in one thing and you have the property in something else, and then we swap. That's what it means when we exchange. Okay, exchange and specialization. There's two different things going on with this. So let me talk about the law of comparative advantage first. So let's go ahead and read this slide out. It says, both parties can benefit if they each specialize in producing those goods in which they have the relative or the comparative advantage, and then trading the surplus. And so this is true even if one party is more productive in all goods. Now for this, for a lot of this stuff, if you guys are, for those of you who are newcomers to economics, if you have, especially if you've never taken a formal economics course before, at the risk of sounding narcissistic, I would strongly encourage you, while you're reading Rothbard here, to be reading in tandem with it, My Lessons for the Young Economist. Okay, so there was a little link to that for this week, talking about the formation of prices and barter, but just more generally, stuff like this with the law of comparative advantage and the nature of property rights and things like that. The Lessons for the Young Economist, if I can give you an analogy, Rothbard wrote Man, Economy, and State to sort of take human action, Mises' magnum opus, and make it easier and not as and couched in everyday language as opposed to the real technical language that Mises used. Well, that's what I tried to do with Lessons for the Young Economist, that I tried to take some of the major themes in Man, Economy, and State, obviously I didn't cover everything, and just distill them down and put them in language that even a junior high student could understand. Okay, and so with a lot of this stuff, even though Rothbard is an incredibly clear writer, he uses economics terminology a lot of times, or jargon. And so some readers, if you've never taken an economics class in your life, you still might find some of his discussion to be a little bit difficult. So if that's happening with you, I would suggest give the Lessons for the Young Economist a try and see if that's helping you bridge the gap. Obviously, too, my study guide for Man, Economy, and State, but even there, if it's not clicking with you. Okay, so as far as comparative advantage, there's a lot that we could say about this. Let me just give you a quick background. So historically, you had the mercantilists. All right, so they were the people that thought the way a nation became richer and more powerful and stronger economically was to accumulate more money, which at the time was gold and silver. So they would so that, you know, the economic ministers advising the King of France, for example, would tell him, look, we need to have policies in place that encourage foreigners to buy French exports. We want to be shipping our wine and so forth abroad and having foreigners send us money to buy it, to buy them. And we want to discourage Frenchmen from importing stuff from abroad. We don't want our people spending money importing sweaters from Great Britain and other things from, you know, and books and so forth from Great Britain. We don't want their stuff because then that's an outflow of money from our country. Right? So they didn't want trade deficits. Right? So the modern hand-wringing over the trade deficit, that goes back centuries. Okay? People have always been suspicious of foreigners trying to, you know, how dare those foreigners send us goods that you know, on better terms than we can make them ourselves. How dare they do that? How dare they trade with us? Right? That was the idea. So that's where the mercantilists were coming from. So perhaps the single most important contribution of the classical economics, people like David Hume, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, is they blew up mercantilism. Right, so there was a lot wrong with classical economics, in particular their theory of value. We've already talked about in this class that it was lacking. But in terms of their analysis of international trade, it was the foundation of what we still do today in many respects. Okay, so the way they did it, so Adam Smith basically focused on examples showing that, look at why, if we're Great Britain and the people in France, if the producers in France can make wine of a certain quality with less labor time than British workers can make comparable tasting wine, well, then we would be stupid to have our workers making the wine. It'd be smarter for us to import the wine from France and then have our workers specialize in the stuff in which they have an advantage vis-a-vis the French workers and then ship them those things in return. And so that way we've got the workers in the two countries specializing in the tasks in which they have what we would now call an absolute advantage. And then we make more total stuff. We, you know, if our workers can make more sweaters per hour of labor than the people in France, and if the people in France can make more bottles of champagne per worker hour than we can, then we can have more total sweaters and more total bottles of champagne if we each have our workers specialize in those things, produce, you know, so in England we're producing way more sweaters than English consumers need, and in France they're producing more champagne than the people in France want to drink, and then we just trade the surplus. So if we do that, because of the nature of the problem that we said, you know, by hypothesis, the British workers, and I'm interchangeably using English and British, even though they're different terms, can make more per hour, and the same thing with the French workers, well then, duh, there has to be, you know, for the same amount of total work hours, we got to have more stuff. And so then if we trade them, you know, there's a way that everybody can have more stuff. People in both countries can have more sweaters per person and more bottles of champagne per person. So, duh, why don't we do that? Okay, so that is the kind of stuff that Adam Smith talked about. But then the classical economists pushed it even further and said, wait a minute. And this is what's attributed to David Ricardo, but some people say other people came up with it first. But in any event, you know, so the kind of arguments Adam Smith made in The Wealth of Nations were like that, where he said, wait a minute, we should import stuff from countries if their workers are better at making those things than our workers are. And it's really obvious, like with the, you know, tropical fruits or something, if the workers in certain regions, just because of the way how much sunlight they get and how much rainfall and whatever, can more easily produce certain fruits with an hour of their labor than people in a real, you know, cold climate can do. So, duh, of course we're going to import fruit from them. Just like people living in Alaska, technologically, yeah, they could have big hothouses and grow oranges in Alaska, but that would be crazy. it makes a lot more sense for them to focus on, you know, drilling oil, and the people in Florida to focus on growing oranges, and then they trade with each other because you can extract more barrels of oil per year and grow more oranges per year if they do that. All right, so that's obvious. That's a no-brainer. That's the kind of stuff Adam Smith focused on. What David Ricardo did is he developed it even more. And so, you know what? It's not just, and I'm using modern terminology. I don't think they use this terminology. He said the advantage of specialization and trade among nations isn't just true for countries where each one has a different absolute advantage. So like in my example, where the English can produce more sweaters per hour of labor, whereas the French can produce more bottles of champagne per hour of labor. It's not just those cases. Even in scenarios where, let's say, the English worker can produce more sweaters and more bottles of champagne per hour of labor compared to some other country, still, both countries benefit from specialization, from producing more of the thing they're really good at, and then trading the surplus with the other people, than if they just, you know, produce for their own home market. Okay, so there, what should they specialize in? Well, they should specialize in the thing in which they have the comparative advantage. So even if they have an absolute advantage in every product, they still can benefit if they specialize in the things in which they have a comparative advantage, meaning, loosely speaking, the things that they're really good in. Okay, so just to make up numbers, if it takes the English worker 1 hour to make a sweater and 1 hour to make a bottle of champagne, and it takes the French workers 2 hours to make a sweater. But hang on, let me do it differently so it comes out. It takes the French workers 2 hours to make a bottle of champagne and 10 hours to make a sweater. Well, then with those numbers, the English workers have the absolute advantage in both sweaters and champagne because it takes fewer worker hours to make either good than it takes the French. So you might think, why would the English want to trade with the French? That's crazy. But no, they would want to, because by having the French specialize in champagne, that's their comparative advantage, because the English, in a sense, have a 2-to-1 advantage in champagne production, but they have a 10-to-1 advantage in sweater production. And so the idea is, relative to a case where each country just has its workers make the amount of sweaters and champagne that its own people are going to consume, you can actually have higher per capita consumption of both goods among both countries if the English take some of their workers out of champagne production and ramp up their sweater production, and the French take some of their sweater producer workers and shift them over into making champagne. Okay? And so it's for our purposes tonight, I'm not going to walk you through it, but in the lessons for the young economist, I give you some examples of that and show you how it works. The sort of personal level analogy, so not focusing on international trade, just at the personal individual level, would be things like a doctor. Okay, a doctor's office, it could be the case that the doctor can take somebody's blood pressure and stick the tongue depressor in the patient's mouth and look in and see if they have inflamed tonsils or whatever the heck they're looking for, I don't even know, and do all that stuff more efficiently. Like maybe the doctor does it a little bit more quickly, and maybe he's more likely to catch a problem than, you know, some nurse practitioner that he might hire. So if the only consideration were who is the best person for that one job of taking the blood pressure and asking the person, have you had any problems, and da da da, the actual doctor may be the better person for that job than the nurse practitioner. But we know in practice that's crazy. The doctor shouldn't waste his time doing that stuff, because when it comes to the stuff that the doctor really does do on a daily basis, those tasks, he's way better than the nurse practitioner is. Okay, so even though he has the absolute advantage in both sets of tasks, his comparative advantage is in, you know, getting the blood pressure and all that from the nurse practitioner and just going in and talking to the patients for 10 minutes. Okay, well, I prescribe that you do this, this, and this because I think what you have is, you know, a bacterial infection. So you need this, there's a prescription, there you go. And he goes and sees the next patient. All right, so he can crank through way more patients that way because he's not wasting all his time taking blood pressure and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's just one simple example of the principle. So that idea is true even at the national level if we want to talk about international trade. So even a country that its workers are more productive than all sorts of things, its people can be richer if they specialize in the areas where they have the biggest advantages. Just like the doctor has a higher standard of living if he outsources some of his tasks of his practice by hiring people who are worse at doing those jobs than he himself would be. Or another simple example we use a lot in economics, if a lawyer hires a secretary who maybe is a slower typist than the lawyer is. So maybe the lawyer, in terms of how many letters could I get out the door per day if I just sat down and banged them out in the typewriter, maybe he could do more than the secretary could. But nonetheless, he focuses on practicing law and hires the secretary to handle his correspondence. All right, so that's another example. Okay. So in terms of social interactions and what have you, the reason this is important is that, especially in the framework of Mises, and Rothbard wholeheartedly endorses it, is that this is the basis of social peace. It's because there is exchange and specialization and a higher productivity of labor when people divide tasks up that we have modern society. All right, so if it weren't for this fact, then Mises thinks society wouldn't be possible. That the reason we've developed these norms for not killing each other and not stealing and so on is that when we respect each other's property rights, that fosters the division of labor, specialization, and then trade. And because of this principle of comparative advantage, we're all fantastically more wealthy doing things that way. Okay, if you, at Mises.org in the media, I have a talk on something like trade and the division of labor or something like that that came out within the last, I don't know, 6 months or so. And there I kind of walk through the various reasons for why that is the case. All right, so here I don't have time to get into it as to why this is true. But there I kind of walk through. But very basically, if everybody had to grow his own food, build his own house, pull his own teeth, you know, perform his own medical operations, we'd all be a lot poorer. Okay, so we all kind of know we all benefit from specializing in various occupations and trading with each other. And so Mises thinks that's the basis of modern civilization. That might not be why we do it. I mean, he thinks that maybe you refrain from killing your neighbor because you would feel bad, but in Mises' view, the reason we've evolved like that and the reason societies have shunned those things and, you know, ostracized or punished people who break those laws is because of this fact. Okay, I think you all know what's going on with this diagram of specialization. So the idea is here's Mr. A over here, and he, instead of picking his own berries and then hunting and fishing and keeping a bunch of chickens and a bunch of cows, the idea is Mr. A is really good at picking berries. So that's what he's going to do. And then he's going to trade the berries for game and for fish and for eggs and for milk. And meanwhile, Mr. B over here, he has the comparative advantage in hunting. He's a better hunter than other people are, or actually more specifically, even if everybody else is a better hunter than B is, his deficiency in hunting is lower than his deficiency in the other occupations. So it makes the most sense when these five people are determining which tasks do we do that B is going to concentrate on hunting. And likewise, Mr. C, his comparative advantage is in fishing. So that's what he's going to focus on and so on. Okay, so each of these, you could draw a diagram like figure 7 for person B, and then you would show B having arrows to and from A and to and from C and D and E, because B would be hunting and getting a bunch of animals and then trading them and the furs and whatever for his berries, fish, eggs, and milk, and so on. All right, so that's the idea. And again, the whole point of all this is with A, B, C, and D, and E specializing in the areas in which they have the comparative advantage, over time, there are more total berries being picked. And there's more total animals being hunted, and there's more total fish being caught. And so that means it's mathematically possible for the per capita consumption of berries and game and fish and eggs and milk to be higher when they do things this way. And so that's why they all benefit from the division of labor. They can all have a higher standard of living because of it. Okay, in the last 10 minutes here or so, let me walk you through this last section of tonight's reading. So here, what we're talking about is equilibrium price determination in a scenario of barter, or more accurately, direct exchange, okay, where the people are trading goods that they value directly, okay, that, or more specifically, they're trading for things that they're going to use. All right, so they're not acquiring goods because they then intend to turn around and trade them again to somebody else. Okay, that's called indirect exchange, and we'll deal with that later in the course. Right now we're talking about direct exchange, and we're trying to get a handle on how are prices determined in this sort of setting. Okay, so we already know about just a one-shot exchange, what happens there. If one person has one thing and the other person has something else, why would they trade? Oh, because they have those reverse valuations. That makes sense. But now, Rofford wants to say, what if we have multiple units of two different goods? How do we determine what the exchange ratio is between those things, or what we would call the price? Okay, so when there's money involved, what's the price? Oh, the price is how many units of money one unit of the thing is. So if I say a car, its price is $1,000 or $5,000, what does that mean? I mean, in a voluntary trade, the person who wants to get the car has to give up 5,000 units of dollars. All right, so if we don't have money yet, though, because we haven't gotten to that part in the analysis, here we're talking about a society where there's not money yet. People just have goods, and they're trading them directly against each other, so there's no money. We can still talk about prices, and the price just means the ratio at which those goods trade for each other. Okay, so that's what we're analyzing here. As far as why is he calling it equilibrium? Well, he's using that term because, as we'll see as we go through the analysis, there's an idea here that we're only going to allow things where all the people involved in the scenario, in a sense, see what's going on and they don't object. Okay, so that'll make more sense as I walk through the numbers. I just want to be clear and make sure you guys get that. The stuff Rothbard's going to be walking us through here, it's not that it necessarily would happen like this. He's saying it would happen like this in equilibrium, where the term equilibrium means nobody after the fact is going to slap his forehead and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe that just unfolded. I would have been better off had I done something differently. Or, you know, gee, if I had known things were going to turn out like that, I would have spoken up earlier. Okay, so that kind of stuff doesn't happen. Okay, so people aren't making mistakes. They're not engaging in strategic bluffs. And then, you know, the other person calls their bluff and it doesn't work. We're not doing that kind of stuff in here. We're saying it's a very stable situation. The price is going to be whatever it's going to be because of the analysis. And all the people involved are going to say, yep, I'm happy with what I've done with my personal possessions given this market price. That's what we mean by equilibrium in this context. Okay, so I'm just going to walk you through a bunch of these diagrams. And again, this is one area where if you're not getting it here, I have a completely a substantially different treatment in Lessons for the Young Economist where I had a different notation. So if you're getting tripped up by these things with the parentheses and all that stuff, I have a totally different way of representing the value scales in Lessons for the Young Economist that nonetheless tells the same story. So if it's not clicking with you here, look at the supplemental readings for this week and go check out that portion. Okay, so this first scenario that Rothbard shows us, no trade is going to be possible, but let's just make sure we see why no trade is possible. So Smith's value scale on the left here, it's the topmost valued thing is 103 barrels of fish, and then 102 and 101. All right, and then a horse is in parentheses, and then 100, and then 99, and 98. Okay, so this is partly why I changed the notation, because this is a little bit confusing. These are not the marginal units. Okay, so Rothbard's not saying by this value scale, Smith thinks the 103rd barrel of fish has a higher margin utility than the 102nd. No, you know it's the other way around. Smith values the 102nd barrel of fish more than he values the 103rd barrel of fish, or rather, I should say, the margin utility of the 103rd barrel is lower than the marginal utility of the 102nd barrel. Okay, so what this value scale means by having 103 at the top and then 102, he means the whole stockpile. He's saying, would Smith rather have 103 barrels of fish, or would he rather have 102? Well, Smith would rather have 103 because it's more. Okay, so that's what is going on with the barrels of fish. And then by putting the horse in here, and the horse is in parentheses, that's saying he doesn't have that yet, but it's in his value scale because he could have it, it's, you know, theoretically. So what this means is, in terms of Smith going from things, to, you know, getting better and better and better up to the best possible, you know, yeah, I like 98 barrels of fish. I would prefer to have 99 barrels of fish. I would prefer to have 100 barrels of fish. I would prefer to have a horse rather than 100 barrels of fish. But I would rather have 101 barrels of fish than a horse. And, of course, I'd rather have 102 barrels of fish than 101. I'd rather have 103 barrels than 102. Okay, so, you know, don't worry, everyone. I'm belaboring this thing just to make sure you get how one of them works, and then we can zip through them. But I want to make sure you really get what this notation means. Okay, so from that information, now that you understand what's going on with this notation, you know that Smith right now has at least 103 barrels of fish, because that's, you know, they're not in parentheses, so you know he's starting out with that. He doesn't have any horses initially, because just to say a horse is in parentheses. And you know he would be willing to trade up to 100 of his barrels of fish to obtain one horse. But he would not be willing to trade 101 barrels or more. Okay, so he'd be willing to trade 98 barrels of fish for a horse. He'd be willing to trade 99. He'd be willing to trade even up to 100. But he would not be willing to trade 101. Okay, and again, you know that just looking at those value scales, because a horse is higher on his value scale than 100 barrels of fish. So if he'd be willing to give up 100 values of fish to obtain one horse, well, obviously he'd be willing to give up only 99 or give up 98, right? Because he wants to keep as many barrels of fish as he can because they're good. On the other hand, you see 101 is higher than a horse, so you'd know he would not be willing to give up 101 barrels of fish to obtain one horse because this value scale is saying 101 is more highly valuable. Okay? All right, so now that I walked you through there, we can be pretty quick with these other ones. Look at the right side. Johnson's the other way around. Johnson starts out with one horse. It's right there. It's not in parentheses. And he doesn't have any fish to begin with. That's why they're all in parentheses. And so what Johnson's value scale says is that it's a similar type of thing. The more barrels of fish he gets, the better off he is. And the horse is embedded somewhere in that list. So looking at this, what can we say about Johnson? We'd say, well, Johnson would be willing to give up his horse if he could obtain at least 102 barrels of fish. Right? Because remember, if he's going to give up the horse and get something in exchange, he better be getting something that's more valuable than the horse he's giving up. And so that's why it's the things that are above it for Johnson. So if he were going to get 102 barrels of fish and he'd be willing to make the trade, well, then obviously he'd be willing to do it for 103 or 104. That's even better. Okay, but the minimum price would be 102 barrels. If somebody only offered him 101 barrels, he would say, no, I'd rather keep my horse. Okay, so now that we know that, we can combine the two sets of facts and say, wait a minute, there's no trade possible. Because Smith over here on the left says, yeah, I would be willing to give anywhere from 0 to 100 barrels of fish to obtain a horse, but not 101 or more, whereas Johnson says, if I were to give up my horse, I would need to be offered at least 102 barrels of fish. And so we see that those two ranges don't intersect with each other. And so that's why Rothbard's saying there's no trade here. These two people could walk up, bargain with each other a little bit, and then walk away and say, no, there's no way we can exchange our property so that we both walk away happier. So no trade's possible. Okay, but now what if we change Johnson's value scale a little bit, which we do in the next slide? Now we see that Johnson, in terms of barrels of fish, his ranking of a horse, of his own horse, has fallen. Okay, so now this guy Johnson here, with his new value scale, he would be willing to trade his horse away so long as he got at least 81 barrels of fish. And then obviously he would do it for 82 or 83 or 84, but the point is the minimum price is 81. Because if it were 80 barrels, well, then he wouldn't make the trade because his horse is higher in his value scale than a potential 80 barrels of fish that he doesn't yet own. Okay, so he's not going to give up something more valuable to get something less valuable. Okay, so that's why now the minimum acceptable price of a horse for Johnson, who's a horse seller, is 81 barrels or higher. And remember over here with Smith, the maximum price of a horse was 100 barrels of fish or lower. And so, boom, now we have it. Now there's a gain from trade. So now we know if these two guys interact with each other and they make a voluntary trade, Rothbard is saying, we know there is going to be a trade, that Johnson's going to give up his horse and Smith is going to give up some of his barrels of fish, and they're both going to walk away happier. Now you're asking me, okay, but what's the specific price ratio? And Rothbard says, well, just from the information we have, we don't know for sure. All I can give you is a range. In particular, I know that it's going to be at least 81 barrels of fish or higher, but at most it's going to be 100 barrels of fish or lower. Okay? Because Smith is setting that upper bound of 100 and Johnson's setting the lower bound of 81. So we know that they're going to trade Johnson's horse and Smith is going to give somewhere between 81 and 100 barrels of fish for it. But that's all we can conclude from, you know, this analysis. So if you wanted to add more assumptions about which person is a better bargainer or something like that, you could narrow it. But in terms of what can we conclude just from their value scales and so on, that's it. Now let me just come back to what I said a few minutes ago about why is this called equilibrium price determination. Because here, you know, and Rothbard even might sometimes use the language to the effect, you might get the sense that if Smith and Johnson talk to each other, that boy, gosh darn it, there has to be a trade. Otherwise, praxeology blows up and they walk away. You know, no, there doesn't, because maybe Smith really wants to keep the price low. Like maybe Smith thinks, you know, I bet you that guy Johnson really values fish, and I bet you he'd be willing to take a price of 85. And so I'm not gonna go higher than 85. Maybe that's what Smith is thinking to himself. And he would be right that Johnson would be willing to trade for 85. 85 would be way up here, okay? But maybe Johnson's doing a similar thing. Maybe Johnson's thinking, that guy Smith, he really wants my horse. I bet you he'd be willing to pay 98 for it. And he would be right. Smith would be willing to pay 98 for the horse. But if those two guys both dig in their heels and go in with that mentality, they might not actually consummate the trade. And they might walk away, you know, each side sort of bluffing, trying to bluff the other ones and digging in their heels, say, take it or leave it. And if they both say, take it or leave it, and then the other guy says, I'm going to leave it, they might leave it. Okay, so that wouldn't be a violation of praxeology. There would be other stuff involved there that, you know, how much does the person value maintaining his stance or his reputation for being a hard bargainer or something like that, okay? So I just want to point that out to you, but it wouldn't be equilibrium, okay? They would be walking away with still having that gain from trade hanging over their heads. So that's what we mean when we're saying we're giving you the analysis of equilibrium price determination. Okay, so again, praxeology does not say these two guys have to trade. We're just saying, given these value scales, if they're going to consummate all the gains from trade and not regret their actions after the fact, then we know there will be a trade and the price will be somewhere in the range of 81 to 100. Okay, I'm already over time here, so let me pick up the speed. Okay, now Rofford is going to show what happens if we start adding people to the market. Well, what that's going to do is narrow the price range. So before we said, yep, there's going to be a trade. One horse is going to go for some barrels of fish, but all economics can tell us is it's going to be somewhere between the price of a horse is either going to be 81 barrels of fish up through 100 barrels of fish. Or conversely, the price of a barrel of fish is going to be anywhere from 1/100th of a horse up to 1/81st of a horse. Okay, so we're talking about prices, but we don't know exactly what the price will be. It's because there's that potential range. But Rothbard's point is you start adding more and more people to the market, and that range collapses. And so that's why in a modern market economy, we can just talk about what's the equilibrium price and just give a number, because in a modern market, there's tons of buyers and sellers on both sides. All right, so here, we're going to illustrate that by saying, with two people, there was that big range between 81 and 100. Now watch what happens. I'm just going to add one more person to one side of the market, and watch. It's going to push on one end of that spectrum, so that the total range now shrinks. Okay, so just to, you know, by just doing one change at a time, we're going to make sure you get the concept. Okay, so who did we add? Hang on a second, I'm getting confused. Before we had Smith and Johnson, and so now we're adding Brown in the middle. Okay, so Smith on the left, remember, before he would be willing to pay up to 100. Now Brown comes into play, and he would be willing to pay 90. Off the top of my head, I'm not seeing how that's going to restrict things, but maybe it will, because I don't see why Smith still couldn't outbid Brown. Okay, well, anyway, why don't I move on to the next thing? Well, for sure what happens is here, we can see it's the next thing. I don't know off the top of my head, and we're running out of time, so I don't want to waste too much time puzzling over, but I'm not seeing why this would necessarily limit the range, the possible prices in this particular transaction, but maybe it would. Because the idea is this, I'll say my doubts aloud, I thought the whole point that Rothbard was getting at here was that we were going to say now the range only goes from 81 to something else, or that it goes from something higher than 81 up to 100, but it still looks like right. I know what's going on. Sorry. My apologies. So what goes on here is now we know that the minimum price has to be 91 or higher. Okay, so yeah. Sorry, everyone, I got mixed up there. Okay, so remember in the previous slide, it goes from 81 to 100. We know there's going to be a trade of Johnson's going to give his horse to Smith, but the price can go anywhere from 81 to 100. Now, because Brown is involved, Brown's actually not going to get the horse, but his presence is going to alter that possible range of prices, because now, let's say Johnson and Smith, you know, we say 82 now. Is that still a viable price? No, it's not. In a sense, Brown knocks out 82 as being a viable price, because if it were going to be 82, who's going to get it? It's either got to be Brown or Smith. They both would be happy to acquire Johnson's horse at 82 barrels of fish, but then the other guy would object, right? And so, again, this is what we mean by the equilibrium part of it, that nobody after the fact regrets his actions. That, let's say Smith gets the horse at 82 barrels, well, then Brown is going to say, wait a minute, I would have been willing to give you 83. And so then Johnson's going to slap his head and say, are you kidding me? I shouldn't have given it to Smith for 82 if you would have given me 83. So it's still possible. There could still be mistakes. We're not saying with these three people and their value scales, it's inconceivable that Johnson sells his horse to Smith at 82. That would still be a voluntary trade. But the point is, Johnson would slap himself in the head if he realized he could have gotten 83 from Brown. And Brown is going to be mad if he realized I could have gotten a horse for 83 barrels of fish when instead I got nothing. Okay, so that's what we mean when we say that would not be an equilibrium outcome. So the only things that could be an equilibrium outcome are if Smith is the guy who ends up with the horse, and the price is at least 91 barrels of fish. Because if it's 91 barrels or higher, then this guy Brown, he's content to not be involved. If Johnson sells his horse to Smith for 91 barrels of fish, Brown is going to say, okay, that's fine with me, because I value my 91 barrels of fish more than I would value that potential horse. And so that's why I'm happy walking away with nothing, just keeping my fish and going home. Okay, so what happened here is by adding Brown, we didn't change the fact that ultimately in equilibrium, Johnson's horse is going to Smith in exchange for some barrels of fish, but what Brown's presence does is it narrows the possible range of equilibrium prices. Before, it could be anything from 81 to 100 barrels of fish. Now it can only be 91 through 100 barrels of fish. Okay, so that's the idea, and if we just kept adding more and more people, it would potentially narrow the range more and more. All right, so that's what's going on there. Okay, we got, I think, just two more slides here. Yeah, just two more slides, and I'll answer your questions. Okay, so now you got the idea. Let me just back up once. Let me show you how you go from this kind of slide to the next one. So here for Smith, this guy Smith, notice his maximum buying price is 100. So Smith, in terms of this market, what is he? He is a potential seller of fish and a potential buyer of horses. Okay? Whereas Brown, what is he? Same thing. He's a potential seller of fish, because that's what he's starting out with, and a potential buyer of horses, whereas Johnson is the opposite. He's a potential seller of a horse and a potential buyer of fish. Okay, so in terms of the market, those are the buyers and the sellers. And then for Smith, you say, okay, what is his maximum buying price? Well, it's 100. Smith would be willing to pay up to 100 barrels of fish for a horse, whereas Brown has a lower maximum buying price. He would only be willing to pay up to 90. And then Johnson, since he is the seller of a horse, you'd say he has a minimum selling price, and it happens to be 81. Okay, so now we know what those terms mean. So here in the next chart, Rothbard's saying, okay, I'm not going to add a bunch of, you know, so now he's got, what, 17 people in the market. And Rothbard's point is here, I'm collapsing that information. I'm not going to draw 17 different value scales. I showed you in the last diagram what it looks like to have three people in the market, one seller of a horse and two buyers of a horse. And then I showed you how you could figure out what their maximum buying prices were for the buyers of a horse. and what the minimum selling price was for the one seller of a horse. Now that you get that, let's assume there's 9 buyers of horses and 8 sellers of horses, and they have different maximum buying and minimum selling prices. Okay, so we could, if we wanted to, draw out all those value scales, but the point is Wofford's trying to save time, saying, now you get the idea, let's make it, there are more people involved. Okay, so again, what I want to make sure you get here is, all the stuff we're going to do later on, you know, supply and demand curves and, you know, shift in supply, shift in demand, you move the curves around, price goes up and down, you could ultimately derive all of that stuff by looking at every single person's ordinal value scale. So we're doing it here from scratch, from the ground up, just to show you that it could be done. But then later, when we're talking about society with 2 million people, we're not going to draw 2 million different individual value scales because that would take too long. But the point is, you could get it. So, you know, the all consumer and price theory can be built up just from people ranking things from best to worst. You don't have to assume that they have utilities that they assign. So this is 32% more utility. Okay, that's what's going on here. All right, so now we've got the buyers of horses and their maximum selling prices and the sellers of horses and their minimum selling prices. So this Z1 of 81 barrels of fish, that is Johnson. See? Over here, Johnson's minimum selling price. So Johnson is person Z1. That's who Z1 is. It's Johnson. Whereas here, the buyers of horse X1, 100 barrels of fish, that's Smith. And then 90 barrels of fish, well, Rothford didn't put him in here. Okay, so Brown doesn't make it into the list of the X's. But this X1, that is Smith, and this is Johnson. Okay, so these other numbers, that's where they're coming from. Rothford saying, I could just make up people who have valuations such that those cutoffs occur at these numbers. Okay, now last step, how do you go from that information to table 2? Let me just walk you through a couple of these. Okay, so at a price of 80, what happens? Well, this table 2, is saying, well, at a price of 80, the quantity supplied is 0 horses and the quantity demanded is 9. But let's make sure you get how Rothbard's deriving that information. That's coming from these two charts. So at a price of 80, how many of these buyers want to buy a horse? They all do, right? Quine demanded is 9 at a price of 80. That information you can get from this, right? Because here, person X9, his maximum buying price is 83. So a price of 80 is lower. So in other words, if person X9, the most he would pay for a horse is 83. And we're saying, what if the price were 80? Would he buy a horse? Yeah, he'd want to buy a horse. But that's true for Mr. X8, because his maximum price is 85 and so on. Okay, so because that price 80, that hypothetical price 80, is below the maximum buying price of everybody in this list, that means all 9 of these people would be eager to try to buy a horse if the price of a horse were 80 barrels of fish. So that's why in this thing, at a price of 80, you've got 9 horses that are demanded, because the people who are in the market potentially looking to buy a horse would all each want to buy one. On the other hand, at a price of 80, the quantity supplied of horses would be 0. Because you go look down here, you say, at a price of 80, how many of these Vs would want to sell a horse? You say, well, Mr. Z1, what is his minimum selling price? His minimum selling price is 81 barrels. And yet the hypothetical price we're considering is 80. So would Mr. Z1 want to sell his horse for 80 barrels of fish? No, because by definition, his minimum selling price is 81. So he wouldn't want to. And then the same is true for all these other guys. So none of these Z guys who start out with the horse would want to sell at a price of 80. And so that's why here, at a price of 80, quantity supplied 0, quantity demand is 9. So clearly, this is not an equilibrium. What we're going to do with this chart, with table 2, is we want to find at what price is the quantity supplied equal to the quantity demanded, and then that's equilibrium. Because here, this price of 80 is not equilibrium. because people are trying to buy nine horses and people are trying to sell zero. So there's a shortage, right? And so that's going to push up the price. So because the suppliers know, wait a minute, why would we try to sell at 80? There's nine people out there who want to buy a horse at 80, but we don't want to sell any. Let's see if we could raise the price. And yeah, that might knock down the quantity and demand, but then we could maybe sell some. That's the idea. Let me just do, I'll do one more and then I'll do the equilibrium one. All right, so let's pick something like 97. We'll just walk through that and then we'll do the equilibrium and that'll be it. Okay, so for a price of 97, what happens there? Well, the quantity supplied, actually, let me do something that's more intermediate so it's more interesting. How about 93? Okay, so the price of 93, what do we got? Seven are supplied. So let's see how that works.
What price did I say?
I'm getting mixed up. 93. Okay, so the price is 93. Seven horses are supplied. So we go back here. Let's make sure we see that. Okay, so we're talking about how many are supplied. So we're going to be down here because these are the sellers of horses. So at a price of 93, would Mr. Z1 be willing to sell his horse? Yeah, because his minimum selling price is 81. 93 is bigger than 81. So if he would be willing to sell for 81 or more, we're asking what if the price were 93 barrels of fish. Would he be willing to do it? Sure thing. So Z1 is in. Same thing with Mr. Z2, Z3, all the way up through Mr. Z7. His minimum selling price is 92, and we're asking about a hypothetical price of 93. Well, 93 is bigger than 92, so yep. Everyone from Z1 through Z7 is in, but Mr. Z8, he would not sell his horse at a price of 93 barrels of fish because this diagram is saying his minimum selling price is 96, okay, and 93 is less than 96. So that's why Z1 through Z3 are in on the supply side. They're all willing to sell their horses at a price of 93. So that's why here, at a price of 93, the quantity supplied is 7. On the other hand, at a price of 93, the quantity demanded is only 3. So let me just make sure we see how that works, and then we're almost done. Okay, so over here, now we're talking about the people buying horses. At a price of 93, would Mr. X1 be in? Well, yeah, because his maximum buying price is 100. So he'd be willing to pay up to 100. So would he be willing to pay 93? Sure he would. So he's in. X2, same deal, 98, but Mr. X3, he's in. His maximum price is 95, and we're asking about a price of 93, so he's in. So that's where the three are coming from, because Mr. X4, he wouldn't do it, because his maximum price is 91, and we're asking about a price of 93. So Mr. X4 through X9, they're all not willing to buy a horse if the price is 93 barrels of fish, whereas these first three guys are. So that's why here at this price of 93, the quantity demanded is only 3. Okay, so 93 also is not an equilibrium price because people are trying to sell more horses than people are trying to buy. So that means the price of a horse is too high, right? People are trying to sell too many, more than people want to buy. So you know, what do? Well, the price has to come down. And so you can go through it. Where do the things exactly balance up? It's at 89. At a price of 89 barrels of fish, you've got 5 people willing to give up 89 barrels of their fish to get one horse. And then you've also got 5 people willing to give up their horse for 89 barrels of fish. And so that's the equilibrium price. Everybody walks away happy. The people who made the trade are happy, and the people who didn't make the trade are happy. Okay, so that's how equilibrium is determined. And so it's a unique price, given these different value scales. There's no range, in other words. We've added enough people to both sides of the market that range that was originally from 100 or 81 to 100 collapsed down to just 89. And so that's the sense in which we can say, with all these people and their valuations, and the stocks of horses and fish that they start out with, the equilibrium price will be 89 barrels of fish for one horse, and at that price ratio, 5 horses will be sold in exchange for five different stockpiles of 89 barrels of fish. Okay, well, I went a lot over than what I had planned on doing, but I think that was an important thing. So I will, I'll go to 40 minutes after, if you guys want to stick around, just so I don't totally scrimp on the Q&A. All right, so I will now switch to your questions for the professor. I'm going to log in. Okay. Jacob Champness says, on page 38, Rothbard writes, producers' goods can never be perfectly nonspecific, equally valuable in all production of consumers' goods, for in that case they would be general conditions of welfare available in unlimited abundance. And he says, how is the nonspecificity the same as abundance? Off the top of my head, I'm not sure, Jacob. I would need to go look at his argument again to see why he's saying that particular thing. But then your next question, he says, since labor is a factor in every production process, is it a general condition of welfare? Obviously not. Again, what gives? Okay, so that one I can answer off the top of my head. To say that labor is I don't think it's true to say that labor is perfectly nonspecific. If he does say that, then it's that he is contradicting himself. But I think the idea is that the substitutability of labor for other things, in particular goods, is different. All right, so I'm trying to think. Like, I think labor is more specific to doing stand-up comedy than to doing car assembly. That you could reduce how much labor you use to make cars, whereas it'd be pretty hard to reduce how much labor you needed to produce stand-up comedy. Right? I think that's it. So you do need labor for both, but I think labor is more important to stand-up comedy. Right? So that's, and I think that's one way of handling that. Okay. Okay. Unfortunately, a lot of you guys are asking mathematical questions, and I don't think I should try to answer those off the top of my head because I would need to write it down and make sure I don't say something wrong off the shooting from the hip. Okay. Lewis says, Rothbard clearly points out that once the equilibrium market price has been established, it must rule over the entire market. Does this only apply to the case of the unhampered market? Is it possible for this assumption to still hold beyond eventual distortions that empirically might occur? Well, again, what he means here, it's that the way we're using that term equilibrium. All right, so what he means is you can't have, in a situation like this, we're back to this kind of thing. Notice we've just been, I was zooming through there and just showing you, well, can it be a price of 91? Well, no, because there's six horses supplied and four horses demanded, blah, 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 blah. But notice I didn't even bother saying this, because I just took it for granted, but notice the implication there is that it's the same price. I was just assuming throughout this analysis that if Mr., to go back here on the chart, I was just assuming that if some guy, if Z4 is going to sell his horse to somebody, to, you know, X, let's see, so to X3 at a price of 92, let's say, well, then we can't have somebody, other Z, selling to somebody else, other X, at a price of 94. Because that would not be an equilibrium. And the point is, because at least one person from both of those trades would say, whoa, 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 why am I paying this amount when that guy over there is only paying this amount? Or the seller at the lower price would say, whoa, why am I selling to you for only this amount when that guy, you know, that buyer over there is paying such a higher price for it? Okay, so that's what we mean here. We're talking about equilibrium price determination. Is we're assuming there's just one price over the whole market. So in a sense, it's not that Rockford's making an empirical claim in that quote you had when he said, let me just bring that up again, where he says, well, you didn't actually have the quote, but where you say Rockford points out that once the equilibrium market price has been established, it must rule over the entire market. It sounds like he's making an empirical claim, but actually that's just the definition, that it's, to say it's the equilibrium market price means it's a single price, because if it weren't, if people were buying and selling apples over here for $2 a pound and selling the same apples over here for $3 a pound, then it's not an equilibrium. Because those sellers at two, if they find out that people are paying three over there, well, they're going to sell over here. And the same thing, the buyers over here at three, if they realize, well, there's sellers down there for two, let's go over there and get that. You know, so it's not an equilibrium price. Now, you're right. In the real world, there are different prices prevailing in different areas, and different people do end up paying different prices. And there's two different things going on. So one is there could be institutional barriers. So maybe, or any kind of barrier. So maybe the reason that apples sell for $2 over here and they sell for $3 over here is that the over here is inside an airport. And, you know, you go through security and everything, and then you're inside, and now if you want to get something at the restaurant, it's a lot more expensive than it would be if you went back outside and walked down the street. But there, those are two different markets, okay, because those are different goods. What you're getting in the airport is food in the airport, and that's more convenient to you if you happen to be in the airport, especially if you've already gone through security and all that stuff, than food that's down the street. It's just like watching a movie in a theater in Manhattan costs more than watching the same movie in a theater in Boise. Right? And it's because they're technically different goods, at least as far as economic analysis goes. All right, so that's the way you handle that. And then the stuff about, you know, what if there's the government interfering. Yeah, I mean that can happen as well, but it's but it doesn't need to require government intervention. So again, what Rockford is pointing out here is that in equilibrium, there's what's called the law of one price, which says if it really is the same good, there's a tendency for a single price to prevail throughout the whole market. But where that law comes from, how would you prove it, is because you say, well, suppose there were different prices. If it really is the same good, then why are the sellers tolerating the low price where the price is low when they could be getting a higher price elsewhere? And why are the buyers where the price is high paying so much when they could get the same thing at a lower price elsewhere? So there, I mean, there's a I guess it's empirical in the sense of, well, how strong do you want to word the claim and how fast do you think the prices would be equilibrated? That's an empirical claim, but to just say the equilibrium price is over the whole market, that's almost the definition, because if it weren't, then it wouldn't be an equilibrium price. Okay. Let's see. Well, I guess that was it. All right, so let me backtrack and see if I can answer any of these more mathematical ones. Okay, so Jacob also asks, he says, on the first sentence on page 38, Rothbard states, when the average product is at a maximum, it equals the marginal product. This would be true if these were continuous functions, but we're working with discontinuous functions, and his own example in table 1 on page 37 has the maximum average unit product of 8 with the marginal product of 10. What gives? Let me just look at that to make sure. I think you're right, but let me double check. We're going to go about 5 more minutes, everybody, and then I'll turn this thing off. I thought if I pulled up the PDF, it'd be quicker, but I think it takes me longer to find it. And the average, okay, yeah, so Rothbard, yeah, on the first sentence of page 38 says, it follows that when the average product is at a maximum, it equals the marginal product. And you're saying that's not even true of his own specific example. Yeah, that does look like. So just in case everyone's confused, if you look at page 37, so Rothbard at the top of page 38 said, it follows that when the average product is at a maximum, it equals the marginal product. But as Jacob points out, that's not even true of Rothbard's specific numerical example on 37, that the average product is maxes out at 8, and the marginal product at that level is 10. So, yeah, that's weird. Off the top of my head, I think you're right. I think it's because of using discrete units. And so if you had continuous functions, then you would get what he says. So because again, he's referring to the stuff before. He says the relationship that always holds mathematically is that as the average product increases, the marginal product is greater, and then as the average product declines, the marginal product is less. And so he says it follows that when the average product is at a maximum, it equals the marginal product. And so, yeah, if you are graphing stuff, and for those of you who have taken standard college-level microeconomics and you're drawing the curves, like marginal revenue and average revenue and that kind of stuff, and average cost and marginal cost, it is true that the marginal pulls the average. And so when the costs are going up, when the marginal cost is going up, the average cost goes up, and then it turns around. And so Rothbard's right, like where the average hits its maximum point is when the marginal one goes through it, because after that point, it's below it. But you're right, that isn't true if you're using discrete units, and it is kind of funny that it's not true in general, and it's not true apparently in the specific numerical example that Rothbard gave. So, yeah, I would agree, Jacob, that that's, but he said is only true if it's a continuous function. Okay, well, why don't I stop there then? There's a couple more mathematical ones that I will look at later, but I think it would take me too long to absorb them to give an answer. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I will get your quiz up and running so that it's ready by Friday, and I will see some of you on – actually, I'll send out an email. We may not have office hours this week because I'm going to be at a conference, but I'll let you know either way when we send out the email about the quiz.